Instagram bio at Queens U Blood Team.
Welcome back to Melodies of Myth, where we explore short historical tales blended through music and culture. I'm your host, Simar Kaur, and I am so glad that you're here. On this show, we usually move between traditions and time periods, tracing how stories travel and how melodies carry meaning. But every so often, we step slightly outside the expected map and follow a different kind of music. One that isn't written by composers or performed on a stage. A kind of music that exists anyway, whether we notice it or not. Tonight's story is about that. About listening for what most people never think to listen for. And what happens when you realize the world has its own frequencies, its own hidden harmonies? It's set far north under a sky that doesn't need an audience, and it follows someone who discovers a sound that belongs to no one, but can still be shared with care, of course. So settle in, take a breath, and let the silence do some of the work. Here is The Frequency Nobody Owned. The first time Tessa heard the Northern Lights, she thought it was a glitch. It was 1:43 a.m. in Yellowknife, and the cold had that special kind of confidence, like it could convince your eyelashes to quit. Tessa stood on the porch of her rental boots, squeaking on packed snow, phone camera already open like proof mattered more than experience. Above her, the sky was doing what it did up here when it decided to show off. Green ribbons, pale and bright, unspooling across the dark like someone had dragged a brush through ink. She lifted her phone. The screen tried to translate it into pixels. It failed in the unusual way, flattening something huge into something shareable. Then her headphones crackled. A thin, wavering sound slipped into her ears like a distant whistle being pulled sideways by wind. It rose, dipped, returned. Not music exactly, not static either. More like the sky was trying to speak in a language that the radio could barely hold. Tessa lowered the phone and stared at the device clipped to her coat. A small receiver she'd bought secondhand, the kind that picked up very low frequent signals, VLF, used by hobbyists, researchers, and the type of person who found comfort in invisible patterns. She had brought it north as a joke at first, a personal object, a way to make the winter feel less like a wall, and now she stood there, breath fogging, listening to the aurora sing. She didn't move for a long time, not because she was afraid to break something, but because she finally understood what her old sound design professor used to say in that maddening but calm tone. He said, "If you're lucky, The world will offer you a sound that doesn't belong to anyone. The next morning, in the bright blue hush that passes for daylight up here, Tessa carried her gear to the community radio station. It was a small building tucked between practical things, a co-op, a snowbank that had given up pretending it would melt soon, and a notice board that always seemed to have the same four flyers. Lost mittens, used skates, a fundraiser, a handwritten warning about a loose dog that had become a local legend. Anyway, inside, the station smelled like instant coffee and warm electronics. Heaven, if you ask me. Anyway, a woman at the front desk looked up. "You must be the new audio tech," Tessa nodded. "Marla," the woman said, already going back to her laptop like names were an efficient exchange and not a ceremony. "Your key fob's on the hook. Studio B is haunted, but only a little." Tessa smiled, unsure if Marla was joking. Up here, people spoke in deadpan the way some places spoke in exclamation points. She walked down a narrow hallway lined with old posters. Local bands, town halls, climate meetings, radio fund drives with slogans that aged in the exact way slogans always did, seeming familiar. She paused in front of one that said, "Listen like it matters." It made her chest tighten, annoyingly. In Studio B, she set her bag down and pulled off the VLF receiver like it was a secret. The room was small, carpeted, soundproofed in that slightly tired way, and the microphone on the desk looked like it had heard a thousand shy voices become braver. She plugged in a recorder and listened back to last night's audio. The aurora came through again, wavering tones, shifting harmonies, tiny bursts like distant sparks. Underneath it all, a bed of quiet that felt less like silence and more like space, wide and indifferent and somehow gentle. Tessa leaned closer to the waveform on her laptop as if she could find the sky in the shape of it. She was supposed to be editing ads for a local hardware store. She was supposed to be learning the station's schedule. She was supposed to be doing her job. Instead, she made a new folder and named it Aurora_takes, like it was already an archive. At lunch, she asked Marla about it, trying to sound casual. She said, "Do people here talk about the lights like they make noise?" She said, stirring powdered soup in a paper cup. Marla raised an eyebrow. "You mean the old Aurora crackles thing?" "People swear they hear it. People swear they don't. People swear a lot up here. Doesn't make it fake." Tessa hesitated. "I recorded something last night," and Marla said, "With what?" And she pulled the small retriever out of her pocket and placed it on the counter like an offering. Marla's mouth tilted into something like approval. "Oh, you're that kind of a nerd." Respectfully, Tessa said, "Yes." Marla tapped the device once with a fingernail. "If you have audio, you should bring it to Ellie." "Now, who is Ellie?" Marla nodded towards the back room. "A resident everything. He'll either tell you it's brilliant or tell you it's cursed." Ellie turned out to be a man in his late 60s and silver hair that looked like it had been cut by someone who didn't believe in fuss. He wore headphones even when nothing was playing, like he wanted to be ready. He listened without interrupting as Tessa explained the whole receiver thing, and then she played the audio. Ellie's face didn't change much, but his eyes did. They softened. And when the clip ended, he lifted one headphone cup off his ear like he needed air. "That," he said, "is worth something." He gave her a look that suggested she'd taken the wrong question. "It is recorded, and that's not the same thing as real?" Tessa asked. Ellie leaned back. Real is complicated, but recorded means that you can share it without stealing it. Tessa frowned. Without stealing it? Ellie nodded toward the window where the snow sat like it owned the world. Everything up here gets taken eventually. Stories, resources, images, souvenirs. People come north, collect what they want, then leave. You're holding something that doesn't belong to you, and you still want to make something with it. And that is where people mess up. I'm just saying, if you're going to put it on air, you do it carefully. And that night, Tessa did not sleep much. Not because she was excited, not exactly, more because her brain kept circling the same thought like it was trying to land. What does it mean to share a sound that nobody owns? She thought of all the ways people use the North as a mood board. The dramatic photos, the mystical captions, the subtle feeling of distance turned into aesthetic. She didn't want to do that. She wanted to do something quieter, something closer to listening than claiming. So she built a segment, piece by piece, like a careful room. She kept it simple. No big declarations, no ancient magic, no pretending she'd unlocked a secret of the universe with a second-hand device and a lucky night. And so she wrote a script that was mostly questions. What are you hearing when you hear the sky? What changes when you listen for something you can't see? What do you do with wonder once you've caught it? She layered the Aurora audio beneath her voice like a tide. She added field recordings from the town, snow crunching under boots, a door closing against the wind, the faint hum of a street light, the distant bark of a dog that sounded like it was arguing with the cold. She almost added music. Soft synth pads, something cinematic, but she stopped herself. The Aurora did not need accompaniment. It was already doing too much. At 7:55 p.m., she walked into Studio A for her first on-air piece. Marla was there, leaning against the wall, pretending she didn't care. Ellie sat in the corner with his arms crossed, looking like a judge and a guardian at the same time. And Tessa adjusted the mic. Her hands shook once, then steadied. The red on-air light flickered on, and she spoke. Good evening. This is Northern Community Radio, and I am Tessa. Tonight, I want to share something I recorded outside last night, something the sky was doing when it thought nobody was listening. She kept her voice calm, not dramatic, like she was inviting the audience into a small and private truth. And then she played the Aurora. The tones filled the studio, thin, wavering, and strange. Not pretty in the usual way, not clean, but alive. And Tessa watched the board levels like they were the only safe thing to look at. She listened for errors, for clipping, for anything that would turn the moment into a technical failure. Instead, the audio held. Her script followed quietly. This isn't the Aurora that your camera sees. This is the Aurora the way a receiver hears it. Electromagnetic signals translated into sound. It's not a song exactly. It's a trace. A reminder that the world is always speaking. Even when it does not speak to us. She paused, letting the Aurora breathe. I am not here to tell you what it means. I think meanings change depending on who is listening and why they're listening. But I will tell you this. When was the last time you listened to something that didn't ask you to respond? Something that did not want your opinion, your post, your attention. Rather, just your presence. She let the next Aurora clip run longer than radio usually allowed. In the station, nobody moved, and when the segment ended, the red light went dark. There was a stretch of silence that felt respectful, like the room did not want to be the first to interrupt the sky. Ellie stood up slowly, as if his joints needed time to agree with his pride. "You didn't narrate over it," he said. "I almost did," Tessa admitted, "but you didn't." Ellie repeated, and this time it sounded like approval. After the broadcast, Tessa checked the station inbox. There were already messages. Some were practical, such as, "What equipment do you use?" Some were curious. "Is that what satellites sound like?" And some were unexpectedly tender. Like, "My dad used to talk about hearing the lights. I did not believe him until tonight." One message was just a sentence, no name attached. It said, "Thank you for not making it into a joke." And Tessa stared at that sentence for a quite long time. She hadn't known that what she was trying to do, avoid turning it into a joke, but it was true. The world was already full of people flattening things into entertainment. She didn't want to be another set of hands pressing wonder into something small enough to carry away. And later that week, she found herself back outside at night, receiver clipped to her coat, breath turning into clouds that felt temporary and honest. Unfortunately, the aurora did not show, but the receiver picked up a faint noise. Tessa did not feel disappointed. That surprised her. Instead, she felt steadier, like she had learned something useful and unflashy, that you couldn't demand the extraordinary. You could only make yourself available to it. At the end, she smiled. Thinking back to the moments, not because she had captured something, not because she could package it into a segment or post it with the right caption, just because, for a second, the world reminded her it was bigger than ever, and she was still allowed to be part of it, simply by paying attention. She stayed outside until the cold began to insist. When she finally turned to go back in, the sky remained dark and quiet, keeping its secrets without cruelty. And Tessa walked indoors, feeling strangely full, like she had eaten a meal made of silence and signal, and for once, that was enough.
Go.
That was Human, an original track of mine, and I played it tonight because it fits the mood of this episode. Quiet, reflective, and a little bit in between. For me, this song is about slowing down long enough to feel what you usually rush past. And remembering that being human is allowed to be messy, soft, and honest. If it resonated with you, thank you for listening, and feel free to reach out with your thoughts on my Instagram at melodiesofmyth_CFRC. But let's continue forward.
Just like children sleeping, we could dream this night away. But there's a full moon rising, let's go. Watch. 'cause I'm still in love with you. On this harvest
brings us to the end of tonight's episode of Melodies of Myth. Thank you for spending this time with me and for letting the story and the music sit with you for a little while. If there's only thing I hope you take from this evening, it's this. Listening can be an act of care. Not just listening to songs, but listening to the people around you. To the quiet details, to the feelings we usually rush past. Sometimes the most meaningful moments are the ones that don't ask us to be explained, only noticed. As you head back into the rest of your afternoon / evening, I hope you carry a bit of that softness with you, whether you are walking home, studying late, or just taking a moment to breathe. This has been Melodies of Myth with me, Simar Kaur. And if you enjoyed tonight's episode, feel free to reach out, share it with a friend, or send in a song suggestion for a future show on my Instagram at melodiesofmyth_CFRC. And until next Friday at 3 p.m., take care of yourself, stay curious, and keep listening to CFRC 101.9 FM.
CFRC 101.9 FM is so thrilled to announce the launch of our brand new accessible website at cfrc.ca. Get your local news, stream your favorite shows, and stay up to date with upcoming events. You can share news tips, book a recording studio, request a PSA for airplay, and oh so much more. CFRC.ca was made possible through the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada and our amazing funding drive donors. Thank you so much.
Hi, this is Allison Crow, and you are listening to CFRC Kingston 101.9.
Folk Everything is your passport to the finest in folk music. Old, new, and everything in between. The wonderful, the wild, and the weird.
Walk quietly by, he won't bother you. He's a busy man, he's got things to do.
It's all here Saturdays from 10 a.m. until 1 p.m. Folk Everything with Hugh on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston.
I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! This is CFRC 101.9 FM, www.cfrc.ca, Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario.
I find young adult fiction writing so much more fun. So people say, what's your book about? I say, well, it's a sci-fi fantasy romance story, sort of. A boy wakes up on a beach with no idea how he got there.
The United States belongs to no particular people because of race, color, or creed. People have come from many parts of the world to construct it.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappelle. Senegal lawmakers send increased anti-queer penalties to president, Kansas confiscation of trans IDs continues, and Guyan's queer young adult novel From Elsewhere for Everyone. Those stories and more this week because you've chosen This Way Out.
I'm Michael Taylor Gray.
And I'm Rhett.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending March 14th, 2026. Homosexuals will no longer breathe in this country, according to one Senegalese MP, during debate on a bill to double the punishments for same-sex sexual activity. The National Assembly passed the measure almost unanimously on March 11th, with only three of the 135 members abstaining. Those convicted of consensual adult queer sex will now face 5 to 10 years in prison, the maximum penalty for sex with a person under 21. It's also a no-promo-homo law carrying 3 to 7 years in jail for supporting LGBTQ causes. Hefty fines are also included. The bill was a campaign promise of President Bassirou Diomaye Faye and Prime Minister Ousmane Sonko. Sonko failed to get it passed as an opposition MP in 2021. Faye is expected to sign it into law, and quickly. UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Volker Turk said the new law flies in the face of the sacrosanct human rights we all enjoy, the rights to respect, dignity, privacy, equality, and freedoms of expression, association, and peaceful assembly. He urged Faye not to sign the bill. Senegal is not the only Western African nation contemplating new anti-LGBTQ laws. Ghana's dormant, draconian Human Sexual Rights and Family Values Bill is once again working its way through the legislative pipeline.
The conviction of the perpetrators who violently robbed and attempted to extort two gay friends in Kenya is being hailed as a landmark victory for the country's LGBTQ community. The two assailants were sentenced to 15 years in prison. They had lured their victims to a home in 2023. They beat them, held them at knife point, and forced them to transfer money under the threat of being killed or outed to their families. The National Gay and Lesbian Human Rights Commission alleges the existence of a larger criminal network that specifically targets queer men. They charge that local security services are often complicit. In a nation where consensual same-sex intimacy remains criminalized, this rare legal victory offers a sign of hope. Activists believe the sentence will serve as a powerful deterrent against the rising tide of targeted blackmail and extortion facing the queer community.
A U.S. federal appeals court has issued a precedent-setting ruling against government-funded gender-affirming surgery. A panel of the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals decided that states have a rational interest in encouraging citizens to appreciate their sex. The judges also sided with West Virginia's stance that states may legitimately refuse to fund procedures they deemed experimental or dangerous. Therefore, they believe states should be able to exclude gender-affirming surgery from Medicaid coverage. This March 10th ruling differs from the U.S. Supreme Court's recent Scarametti decision in a major way. It extends gender-affirming care restrictions to transgender adults for the first time. It's also the first decision from a federal appeals court to explicitly apply the legal framework used for minor care bans to adult health care. Legal experts are alarmed at the court's suggestion that if a state can refuse to pay for such care, it may also have the power to ban it entirely. The ruling faces sharp criticism from medical professionals who maintain that gender-affirming surgery is a medically necessary evidence-based treatment for gender dysphoria.
A different U.S. federal judge has ruled on the side of transgender health care rights. In Connecticut, District Judge Victor Bolden says that Aetna Life Insurance must reconsider its denial of coverage for gender-affirming facial reconstruction surgeries. Bolden rejected Aetna's motion to dismiss a proposed class action lawsuit, finding that the company's categorical exclusion of these procedures is likely discriminatory under the Affordable Care Act. The ruling includes a preliminary injunction requiring Aetna to reassess the denied claims of two transgender women. Bolden emphasized that denying access to this medically necessary care constitutes irreparable harm by continuing to aggravate the plaintiff's gender dysphoria.
New York Attorney General Letitia James is ordering NYU Langone Health to immediately resume its transgender youth health program. She says that its recent closure violates state non-discrimination laws. U.S. President Donald Trump's threatened cuts to the federal funding of hospitals that offer gender-affirming care to minors led the New York City health provider to shutter the program in February. In a letter to the hospital, James's office defined transgender youth as a protected class and warned that it is illegal to deny them medically necessary care while providing similar treatment to non-transgender patients. Officials emphasized that the sudden discontinuation of such care can lead to severe negative health outcomes for a vulnerable population. James maintains that federal pressure does not override state requirements. She promises further action if the hospital fails to comply.
A Kansas judge is refusing to block a sweeping new law that invalidates the driver's licenses of transgender Kansans and criminalizes their use of public bathrooms. Douglas County District Judge James McCabria denied a request for a temporary restraining order against Senate Bill 244 on March 10th. The law that was fast-tracked by the legislature earlier this year mandates that all state-issued IDs reflect sex assigned at birth. It's also been called a bounty bill in that it creates a private right of action. Individuals can sue those they suspect of using the wrong restroom for up to $1,000 in damages. The ACLU argued that the law causes irreparable harm to trans people. They claim that their ability to hold a job, go to school, or go about their daily lives is threatened, but the judge said they failed to prove the law would lead to widespread harassment. Kansas Attorney General Chris Kobach made one small concession. Trans people's invalidated IDs won't be added to law enforcement databases until March 26th. However, the law remains in full effect as the legal challenge continues.
Unfortunately, Kansas is not the only U.S. state targeting the rights of its transgender residents. One of the nation's most extreme transgender bathroom bans just passed the New Hampshire House of Representatives. The legislation mandates that a person's so-called biological sex determine their use of facilities in public buildings, including parks and airports. The bill offers a unique enforcement mechanism. Asserting one's gender identity to access the prohibited spaces is the criminal act. As civil rights violations, every rest stop could result in a fine of up to $5,000 and jail time. It lets private businesses off the hook for discrimination lawsuits if they restrict bathroom access based on sex assigned at birth. Advocates warn the measure puts the state at odds with its New England neighbors, who hold a long-standing pro-LGBTQ rights consensus. The bill's move to the state Senate makes New Hampshire part of the national legislative campaign targeting transgender rights.
Not to be left out of the war on transgender people this week, President Trump has shoehorned it into his top legislative priority, the Save America Act. Yes, it could get even worse. Trump now says he won't sign any pending legislation into law unless Congress adds anti-transgender provisions to his cherished voter suppression bill. It's not enough that the bill mandates voters present in-person proof of citizenship. In a recent Truth Social post, Trump demanded that it also be expanded to include a national ban on pediatric gender-affirming care, as well as a ban on transgender athletes in competitive sports. White House Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt confirmed the new strategy, describing the additions as common sense priorities. However, the move does nothing to break the stalemate in the United States Senate and the Democrats' promised filibuster.
Finally.
Do you trust me?
I trust you.
Cue the romantic music and open your eyes near the reflecting pool in Washington, D.C.'s National Mall. There at sunset in all their bronze glory, is it Jack and Rose on the bow of the Titanic? No. It's Donald Trump and Jeffrey Epstein riding high together in an unauthorized sculpture entitled The King of the World. Secret Handshake is the organization behind this and other satirical Trump statues that have appeared on the mall in recent months. The caption on this one reads, "The tragic love story between Jack and Rose was built on luxurious travel, raucous parties, and secret nude sketches." This monument honors the bond between Donald Trump and Jeffrey Epstein, a friendship seemingly built on luxurious travel, raucous parties, and secret nude sketches. The installation hit its permanent iceberg on March 13th when, like the mock Gilded Age friendship it parodies, it took a dive.
That's News Wrap, global queer news with attitude, for the week ending March 14th, 2026. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap was written by David Hunt and Lucia Chappelle, produced by Brian DeShazer, and brought to you by you.
Thank you. Help keep us in ears around the world at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast and much more. For This Way Out, I'm Rhett. Stay healthy.
And I'm Michael Taylor Gray. Stay safe.
Hi, this is Thorgy Thor, and you are listening to This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine heard on over 200 radio stations worldwide, the World Radio Network, and on the World Wide Web. Keep listening.
You're listening to This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine. Now it's time to rewind the rainbow. This is The Rainbow Rewind,
where we take a quick look back at the people and the moments that made queer history.
I'm Brian DeShazer.
And I'm Sherry Lund.
This week, we honor the March birthdays of Bayard Rustin and Donkil Hefner.
Born March 17, 1912, openly gay Bayard Rustin was best known as being the architect of the first March on Washington for Civil Rights.
The United States belongs to no particular people because of race, color, or creed. People have come from many parts of the world to construct it.
Donkil Hefner was a founding member of the Gay Liberation Front in Los Angeles in 1970. That was one of the first organizations to bring gay rights to the general public's attention in the United States. He also co-founded the LA Gay Community Services Center in 1971, which later became the Los Angeles LGBT Center. And if that wasn't enough, he was also a co-founder of the spiritual, countercultural Radical Fairies movement.
Pleased to have Donkil Hefner and Mark Thompson with me on the 30th anniversary of the Radical Fairies.
We cast a sacred circle in fairy love. We cast a sacred circle in fairy love. We cast a sacred circle in fairy love. We cast a sacred circle.
Now let's rewind to a few March key queer milestones. In March 2021, Dr. Rachel Levine became the first out transgender federal official to be confirmed by the Senate. In 2006, Brokeback Mountain, Capote, and Transamerica all received Oscars. And in 1997, the Clinton administration convened the first official meeting to discuss gay and lesbian rights at the White House.
A reminder that our history is built on courage, creativity, and community.
That's this week's Rainbow Rewind, because remembering our past fuels our pride. I'm Brian DeShazer.
And I'm Sherry Lund. Stay tuned. More This Way Out is coming up.
Our listeners support This Way Out in many ways.
By subscribing to our e-newsletter.
email us at info@thiswayout.org.
And through your financial contributions to our program.
More information about how you can give is online at thiswayout.org.
Thank you.
Kestrel Guyon is a storyteller, a queer storyteller. At a time when queer stories, queer voices, are cast as dangerous, purveyors of a radical ideology that blurs the traditional boundaries of gender identity and sexual expression. And it's true that this thoughtful, soft-spoken Brit is, in a decidedly understated manner, changing the narrative. Crafting characters, stories, even alternate universes that are familiar yet radically different, where the past and present collide, where life and death are states of mind, where love is love. Softness, Guyon writes, feels like a form of resistance. Stories should leave a mark, not a scar. I'm David Hunt. I sat down with Kestrel Guyon recently, shortly after the release of their newest book, The Boy from Elsewhere, a young adult novel that combines time travel, alternate realities, and an ancient bloodline, and includes queer characters and a same-sex romance. I asked Guyon about the audience they write for.
In terms of the fiction books that I write for a mainly young adult audience, although I write for young adult and upwards. I think young adult fiction that is aimed at sort of 13 or 14 plus is actually really at its best when it is also accessible for adults who want a lighter read. The world is such a difficult place to live in right now for everyone. And, you know, sometimes grown-ups, sometimes the adults want a break from that and to read something a bit more entertaining and a bit easier to engage with and a bit easier to digest. So I suppose in terms of the fiction that I write, it is for teenagers and young adults and adults who are looking for some escapism that is a little bit less heavy duty than reading Tolkien, for example. As much as I love reading Tolkien, there's a time and a place. But I do write other things as well. I write poetry, which has a kind of broad adult audience mostly, and do some writing in and around theatre that's mostly aimed at adults as well. So broad set of audiences for the stuff that I do, but I find young adult fiction writing so much more fun because it's an audience that doesn't tolerate being patronized in any way. But it is an audience that is broad and diverse and just so fun to write for.
Yeah, and I have to admit, I'm not a consumer of young adult fiction. And so I didn't know what to expect when I read your books. And then I was sort of flummoxed. I was like, I love this book. What does that say about me? Am I just young at heart? Or is there something universal about the writing?
I think good young adult fiction is quite universal. It's, I think young adult just means, it's a bit of an odd label, really. It just means accessible fiction. And I don't think you have to be young at heart, or I don't think there has to be any kind of shame in adult readers wanting something that's accessible to read now and then. I think it's such an interesting place we've got ourselves into, in the same way that, you know, poetry scholars are very gatekeepy around poetry and who can enjoy it and how they should enjoy it and those kind of things. We've got ourselves into this kind of place in the world where we say, no, grown-ups should read difficult books. Books should, you know, books should be hard to get through. Books should make you think. Books should, you should take 3 months to read a book. And actually, sometimes it's nice to have something that's more accessible, and there shouldn't be any shame around that at all. It should just be another thing that people can enjoy.
So your new book, The Boy from Elsewhere, when people ask you that haven't read it, ask you about it, how do you describe that book in a sort of the elevator speech, I guess, fashion?
Oh, so it's very genre bending, which I have been very intentional about. So people say, what's your book about? I say, well, it's a sci-fi fantasy romance story, sort of. A boy wakes up on a beach with no idea how he got there and meets someone else, and they decide to help them and end up on this adventure, kind of gathering friends and family around them and end up saving the world. And it's all as random and as kind of unusual in its development as that. Like, we learn what's going on as the characters do, and we see kind of glimpses into the pasts of various different characters through a few sort of diary entries and things like that that throw back. But ultimately, the book is about coming together, celebrating differences, helping each other, lifting each other up, and then becoming greater than the sum of our parts in the service of something huge.
And so you craft the story by telling it from different points of view, from different times even. The time sort of is, it's very fluid.
Yes, and so this book is the first book in a series as well. So there are many things in the first book that I have deliberately included and left dangling, because that's a much bigger thread in book two or book three as a three-part series. And so it's been really fun actually writing a book knowing that it's part of a series, because that's giving me the opportunity to introduce concepts but not have to resolve that until later, which I think has proven interesting in the feedback I've been getting from readers. I've had more than a dozen messages pop into various inboxes online from people that have just said, how dare you end on a cliffhanger? I want to know. I want a resolution to all these things, which is, of course, coming. But I like the fact that I haven't had to tie up every loose end by the end of book one.
Some of your young characters seem wise beyond their years. And I think that in a lot of ways contradicts the prevailing media narrative about the Generation Z as being sort of clueless or being overly sheltered. Why did you choose to make your young characters, you know, sort of resilient and wise? I mean, was that a conscious choice, or is that something that's reflected in your experiences with young people?
Yeah, I mean, they're there because they're based largely on real people. Particularly Ellie in this most recent book, who is 13 and just so resilient and strong-minded and clever, is based on a young person that I know. It's the daughter of someone that I've worked with. And, you know, that these people absolutely exist in their kind of strong-willed glory. And I think it's really important to show that there are people like that in the world, and that young people aren't all growing up in this kind of content-infused nightmare, that some people are continuing to just grow up and be brilliant and unique in themselves. And that does echo a lot of my experience growing up as well. I think, yeah, you know, I'm autistic, and growing up in that world of you know, being an autistic LGBTQ plus young person at a time where none of those things were really talked about was an interesting experience. And I have seen the confidence of newer generations growing up without some of the same restraints. And I think actually writing those characters is really important, and writing characters that are role models that I would have needed when I was that age as well is really important.
Yeah, you write on your website about growing up in a home where there wasn't a lot of money, and growing up as a queer kid. You write about feeling a sense of difference and desiring having a deep desire for connection with others, and that certainly informs your writing. How would it not?
Absolutely. I think ultimately, you know, writers bring so much of themselves to any story, as do readers. I mean, the second a story is out there in the world, it is read through the lens of the reader. So every different person that reads something that I've written will come to it with a different set of expectations, a different set of experiences in life. And, you know, I can only hope that the experiences that I have had that bleed through into the writing vibe well with the experiences that other people have had as they start to read the writing.
And then how can people find you online?
So I have some social media. I'm on Instagram, ks.tr.al, where you'll find quite a lot of pictures of food, because I quite enjoy food. I can also be found on Blue Sky and on Mastodon using the same handles. But mostly these days via my website, so kestr.al, where I semi-regularly update a newsletter, and there's various bits of information around how to find me all through there.
I'd like to thank Kestrel Guyon for talking with me for this program. Check out their newest book, The Boy from Elsewhere, a young adult queer adventure that speaks to the young adult in all of us. For This Way Out, I'm David Hunt.
Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. News Wrap was reported this week by Rhett and Michael Taylor Gray and produced by Brian DeShazer. The Rainbow Rewind was written and produced by Sherry Lunn and co-host Brian DeShazer. Tycho Tycho performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks Richard Merck and Brad Payton of Silicon Valley in memory of Greg Gordon for his years of service to the LGBT community and all the listener donors who make this program possible. Ask us about how you can join them. Look for This Way Out Radio on social media, email us at info@thiswayout.org, or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For everyone at This Way Out, I'm Lucia Chappell. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org or wherever you get your podcasts, and on CKDU Halifax, Nova Scotia, KCUR Riverside, California, WWUH West Hartford, Connecticut, and a wide array of community terrestrial and internet radio stations around the world, including this one. Stay healthy, stay safe, and stay tuned, y'all.
I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! This is CFRC, 101.9 FM, www.cfrc.ca, Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario.
Hey, it's Emily Steele, and you're listening to CFRC 101.9 FM.
Hi, this is Jen Grant, and you're listening to CFRC in Kingston.